read by Tom Sanders.
Sir Andrew Davis, the former chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, has died. He was 80. In a career spanning decades, he served as the principal conductor of the Toronto and Melbourne Symphony Orchestras and worked as Glyndebourne's music director. Sir Andrew conducted the last night of the Proms a number of times and was noted for his humorous speeches. He had a particular focus on conducting works by British composers, such as Sir Michael Tippett and Sir Harrison Birtwistle. Russia had reacted angrily to American politicians passing a package of military assistance to Ukraine worth around $60 billion. Moscow says Washington is wading deeper into a war that will end in humiliation, and the bill shows the US wants Ukraine to fight to the last Ukrainian. The aid, including ammunition and air defences, could begin to reach the country in the next week. The Energy Secretary and Net Zero Secretary Claire Catino has said that she doesn't believe the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Mark Rowley, should resign over the force's handling of pro-Palestinian protests, but stressed there had been a serious misstep. The Met has issued two apologies after an officer told a Jewish man that his presence near a march was causing a breach of the peace and he could be arrested. Ms. Catino told the BBC's Laura Koonsberg no one should be told they couldn't go about their daily life because of their identity. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has described the Metropolitan Police's treatment of the man as concerning. Ms. Catino has defended the government's record on tackling climate change. She was responding to comments by the outgoing head of the government's climate change advisers, Chris Stark, who said Rishi Sunak had set back progress towards net zero carbon emissions by delaying future changes. Ms. Catino said ministers had to strike the right balance between cutting emissions and protecting consumers from increased costs. Thousands of people have been attending a candlelit vigil in Sydney to remember those who died in last week's stabbing at a shopping centre. Joel Couchy killed six people, mainly women, and wounded 12 others. He was shot dead by a police officer. A nine-month-old baby girl, whose mother died, has been released from hospital. The weather forecast: thick cloud and spells of rain this afternoon in the south and east of Scotland. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Satnam Sangera is a best-selling writer and journalist. He grew up in Wolverhampton to Punjabi parents in a home where, in his words, no one read books or owned them, let alone wrote them. When he started school, he couldn't speak English, but he went on to graduate from Cambridge University with a first-class degree in English language and literature. He started out writing for newspapers, winning the Young Journalist of the Year at the British Press Awards in 2002. He now writes for The Times. In 2008, he published his memoir, The Boy with the Top Knot. More recently, he's focused on our colonial history. In 2021, he published Empire Land, How Imperialism Has Shaped Modern Britain, which was named a Book of the Year at the National Book Awards. Then came Empire World, How British Imperialism Has Shaped the Globe, which quickly became a bestseller. Satnam, we're going to hear Bach, John Coltrane, Debussy, but we begin with a piece by Jasdeep Singh Degun. Tell me about this one.
Well, as well as growing up in a house with no books, also grew up in a house with no real music. There was only religious music. I had no real musical education, maybe 6 months on the recorder, that was it. And because the religious music was there all the time, I never really listened to it or appreciated it. And it was actually this track which made me realise it's really beautiful, because this track takes that kind of music and applies it to a secular subject. And I think it's stunning.
Thank you.
Fascinated that you only realised later quite how beautiful it was.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, every week in the local temple there'd be musicians coming from India, like, doing amazing things on stage, and we just saw it as part of the furniture and didn't really notice it.
And what were they singing about? Apki Khushi, what does that mean?
Your joy is my joy. I think it comes from a South Asian interpretation of Orpheus. But I've got to know the musician, Jasdeep Singh Degan, a bit. He's an amazing sitarist. And it's amazing that people like that, like second-generation immigrants like me, are taking up those traditions and producing amazing music.
And that marriage, too, of different cultures, because they had members of the Orchestra of Opera North, the Orpheus Ensemble, and Jasdeep's touring band, all working together.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that already started happening in my late teens. I remember seeing Bali Sugu, this Indian musician, on Top of the Pops when I was about 16. And that's when I first noticed that actually you can fuse Asian culture with British culture and make amazing things.
You can get it horribly wrong too, can't you? I mean, you can actually do sort of cod versions of sitar music and vice versa. But maybe this is one of the answers to the problems you write about so much, which we'll come on to later, that through art, through music, there is a coming together and understanding.
Totally. And cultural appropriation annoys me as a controversy because I think all culture is appropriation. But you're right, you can do it well or you can do it badly.
You say, Satnam, that this was very similar to the religious music you grew up with, and your mum was very keen that you were brought up as a practicing Sikh. What did that entail?
Well, quite unusually, I guess I had long hair. I didn't, a lot of Sikhs, very religious Sikhs, don't cut any hair on their body, except my brother didn't have long hair. My dad didn't have long hair. So my mum basically became quite religious when she had me and raised me this religious experiment within a family that wasn't in itself particularly religious. So that was quite odd. And it put all sorts of expectations on me, which I struggled with. And I was, I think, a massive introvert and quite a shy, sensitive boy. And looking different, even within my family, compared to my brother, made me very self-conscious.
You must explain a little bit about what then happened with your hair, because from not cutting it, you then were encouraged to comb it every day, and then hence your book, a very charming book, The Boy with the Top Knot.
The Boy with the Top Knot, yeah. Basically, I eventually cut my hair when I was around 14, and it was a really big thing to do because my mum was so keen on me being raised and being religious. And I was really religious at the time. It's just that I came to the conclusion that I didn't need these outward signs of religiosity to have my Sikh faith. She remembers it differently, of course. She says that actually she was fine with me cutting my hair. But I remember it being a long, drawn-out agony.
You were 14 when you cut it off.
Yeah, I went to the barbers, and my hair at the time went all the way to my knees. So it was an amazing scene, I guess, to undo it in public and to have a man cut it off.
It's like cutting off part of yourself in one way.
It was, and I still remember it. I still have those dreams where I have the long hair. Now I wish I had a bit more hair.
Well, you're pretty well covered, I'd say. Tell me a little bit more about your family life, growing up in a busy household in Wolverhampton.
I mean, my dad was completely illiterate. My mum didn't have great English, though she understands it now. It was really warm and loving, but also disconnected from Britain, I thought. Well, looking back, you know, in that everyone was Punjabi. Everyone on the street, almost everyone on the street, the shopkeepers, the doctor, the priests. And we were kind of raised in this Punjabi village in the middle of Wolverhampton.
And the music that did begin to infiltrate into your life and that you began to love, what would that have been?
It was BBC Radio. God bless BBC Radio. So I did the normal journey, Radio 1, so I got really into pop music, then Radio 2, then Radio 4, and then eventually Radio 3, right? As you become more and more sophisticated and pretentious.
It's interesting how people do go through those gradations and then end up wanting something that is perhaps more profound.
Yeah, I listen to music constantly. I actually listen to it while I write, which I know is quite unusual. I even listen to loud hip-hop when I write sometimes.
And were you exposed to musical instruments? To play, to learn?
I really wanted to have music lessons when I went to Wolverhampton Grammar School, and I got an assisted place to go to this really posh school. But my parents couldn't afford it, and so I couldn't pursue that passion. But actually now, I actually think being a fan of music is great. You don't have to do it. I'm quite glad that I'm a writer rather than a musician. Some of my musician friends at my age are really struggling, especially when they're having to like DJ in nightclubs at the age of 48. You know, I think it's more dignified to be a writer in a way.
Well, the music you've chosen next, I think, comes from just about the first classical CD you bought.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what it's called. It's probably something like The Best Adagios Ever. And I remember the price, it was £2.99. And for me, listening to classical music as a teenager was a way to be an introvert in a very extroverted house and an extroverted culture. As a way to be quiet, I'd put on my headphones and pretend I had my own bedroom, because I never had my own bedroom until I went to university. And it was a way to just be by myself.
And what is it about this music in particular that you have come to love?
It's something, it's very direct about the melody. It's a very stunning, clear melody. It's not as complex as some classical music when I started listening to it. And, you know, the keyboard in it just literally sings. Thank you. Explain how opposite that was in every possible way to the bhangra music that was being played in the factory where I worked at the time. And I think that was an appeal for me. It was just completely different and felt very quiet, at least the first half of that piece anyway. And for me, it was an entry into a new world. I could see why, as someone who doesn't know much about classical music, why I was drawn to that, because the melody is very clear, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there isn't much counterpoint in that. It's just the bass plucked strings.
I saw it being played live, actually, recently in Amsterdam. Just an amazing experience.
We heard the Largo in Presto from Bach's Keyboard Concerto in F Minor, performed by Andrea Padova and the Mainz Chamber Orchestra. Your book, Satnam Sangira, The Boy with the Top Knot, A Memoir of Love, Secrets and Lies, came out in 2008. And it begins with a discovery about your family as they're packing to visit India.
Yeah, I basically didn't know that my father and my sister suffered from schizophrenia. I knew there was something going on with them, but I didn't connect that word, that diagnosis, with them. And it was quite a shock to hear it. But looking back, I think my mum made sure that I was protected. She felt like a lot of other children had been adversely affected by the diagnosis and the, you know, the repercussions of the illness. And she wanted to kind of bring me up in this bubble, which she did. But then, you know, my life at the time involved interviewing celebrities and artists and writers. And it made no sense that I was interviewing these people about their lives. And I knew very little about my own family life. So I basically gave up my job to write my family memoir.
When you did come to terms with it, did you realise the significance it had perhaps played in your family, especially from the point of view of your mother?
Absolutely. I mean, it totally shaped her life and the life of my siblings. But also, I think there's something to be said for not having a diagnosis, because you go from saying, oh, this is just a person who's a bit odd sometimes, to this is a person with that condition. And it starts to explain everything and you can overdo it. And there's a lot to be said for just seeing people as people.
Your mum was very resourceful, wasn't she? Because she was working, sewing dresses at home.
Yeah, she's an incredible woman, my mother. Also very, very wise, given she barely had any education. The wisest person I know, the person I go to with any crisis, even now. And I feel very lucky to have had her. And I feel like sometimes I have, like, Nelson Mandela as a mum. Everyone loves her. We all compete to look after her. It's not a burden for any of us.
You actually had a job yourself at a sewing factory for a while, didn't you?
It was the same factory as my mum, actually, yeah. I was working sometimes, you know, for 90 hours a week in school holidays. It's the only part of my childhood where I actually think it was really bad. And I look back at it and I think, God, I could have learnt an instrument. I could have learnt a language. Instead, I just spent years sewing buttons and buttonholes into blouses. And even my mum feels bad about it now.
And was it very affecting to find that your sister had this condition as well as your dad?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, at the time, she'd had kids herself. And I think there's something about being a mother and having schizophrenia that's even harder on the children than if you have a father. Because, you know, you look to your mother for so many things. And if they are disturbed mentally, it can really, really affect you. It's amazing how well her children have turned out.
I think one should say at this point that despite some heart-wrenching discoveries, the book's very funny.
I'm glad you say that, because, you know what, my mum is very funny. I also think there's something intrinsically funny about Punjabi culture. I mean, most of the Punjabi hits over the years, like, say, Goodness Gracious Me, Bendy Like Beckoner, have always been comedies. And I think there's something about Punjabi life that lends itself to that.
And also, of course, there's that wonderful split between your life as a journalist in London and then what's happening back in the Punjabi household.
Yeah, I look back and the things I did, I mean, to make sure my mum didn't know I had a white girlfriend. I mean, she'd visit occasionally and I'd totally redecorate the flat. I'd put up pictures of Guru Nanak everywhere, and it was quite extreme. And my mum now apologises for that quite a lot.
Because she was under the impression that you never had a girlfriend, never had sex, keep away from meat and egg products on Sundays and Tuesdays to appease the ancestor spirit, all of these things.
Yeah, I mean, she's come such a long way because, you know, at this Christmas, I mean, I have a Muslim girlfriend, my niece has a Muslim boyfriend, another niece has a white Christian boyfriend, and we were all sitting around the table at Christmas, and my mum, happy with all of it. And I think it takes sometimes one person in the family to break the mold, and everyone else can follow. I sometimes slightly resent that it had to be me. But I force my nephews and nieces to express their gratitude.
Tell us about this next piece and why you chose it.
Oh, it's Misty Blue by Dorothy Moore. I love this because, for me, it shows you how music has no racial boundaries. If you grew up in the West Midlands like I did, you know, a lot of the bands like the Specials, UB40, involved white men playing black music or vice versa. We didn't really see it in racially bounded ways. And this song, which was originally a country song, is such a soulful version, and you never would guess it was written as a country song. And it just shows you how daft it is to draw racial boundaries, as it's been shown recently by Beyonce, who's ended up topping the country music charts in America. I love that she's doing that because I think it says something important about genres and race.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world.
I'm smiling because it's one of the most melancholic songs ever.
Dorothy Moore with Misty Blue, composed by Bob Montgomery. How hard did you find writing honestly about your life, Satnam? Were you worried how your parents would react to your writing, to putting it down in black and white?
In a way, I was protected by the fact that my family don't read very much. You know, it's, I think the more middle class your family is, the harder it is to write about your family, right? Mm-hmm. One of my sisters who's in the book still hasn't read the book. She's just not much of a reader, you know. She's read my kid's book about Empire, the first book of mine she's ever read. She read it this year. Mm-hmm. But my parents have not read it. I did worry about exposing them to things. So everything that's in it, I ran it past them and changed things if they didn't want it. And my sister, who's ill, read every single passage and asked me to take out a whole chapter and also added a load of her own words. And I'm so glad I did that because it made, when it got adapted for TV, it made the whole process really positive and it involved my whole family and we all got something out of it. I didn't feel like I was exploiting them. You should ask them if they felt that way, but I don't think I did.
What was it like leaving this family home when you got a place at Cambridge?
This is the thing about social mobility. It's always seen as a great thing, social mobility. It obviously is, in a kind of policy way. But whenever you move class, you lose something, you know, because, yeah, you become more educated and more middle class, but the people who you leave sometimes can't recognise you anymore. You can't join in the same way. Even today, one of my nieces, who is university educated, calls me posh because I've lost my Wolverhampton accent.
And what made you want to become a journalist?
It's quite a bizarre story, but everyone in my family worked in a factory and I thought I'd work in a factory, or maybe one of my cousins who worked as a manager in a building society, that maybe I'd reach those heights. But then when I was about 16, Radio 1 were running a competition with Michael Jackson's now discredited Heal the World charity. It was open to kids and it's a writing competition on how to heal the world. And I entered and I won the competition. And the prize was to go to LA to see Michael Jackson perform at the Super Bowl. And that was when I realised that writing could be something for me.
And what was it like when you did go? I don't suppose you actually met him, but you...
I got pretty close. I was I met Phil Collins, hung out with Jackie Brambles from Radio 1. It was bizarre. Someone who's barely left Wolverhampton to be in that world was really exciting. But also, I felt incredibly homesick as well. So it was conflicting feelings.
The next piece of music came about, perhaps well surprisingly, as a result of your lifelong obsession with George Michael.
And I feel embarrassed about this slightly, although I also think he's great. But this is the thing, if you don't have people training you in music or introducing you to music, you get influenced by whoever you come across. And my sister was a huge George Michael fan. But then George Michael introduced me to a load of other music because he covered a lot of Stevie Wonder, so I discovered Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye and Debussy because he sampled this for one of his tracks. And then I went off and listened to it. And then I listened to quite a lot more Debussy.
But that's a very good advertisement in a sense for just having an open mind rather than a stereotyped set of ideas or rules, isn't it?
I hope so, yeah. And I feel a bit intimidated coming on Radio 3 because I listen to it a lot and it's changed my taste in music. But also because I'm not trained, I feel slightly fraudulent. But I do think that however you...
But we all feel fraudulent.
Do you? Do you feel fraudulent?
Well, I mean, at times. I mean, you know, yes, of course, part of you often thinks, can this be real? Am I really any good? You know.
But you said that you used the word counterpoint early on, and to be honest, I didn't understand it. So that I had a massive feelings of imposter syndrome then.
Let me tell you straight away, counterpoint is when you run a counter melody to the top one, and it fits absolutely naturally and even harmonises it.
Ah, you've explained it very well. But yeah, I do honestly feel that wherever you get inspired, it's great. And don't be pretentious about it. You don't have to hide how you discover music, as long as you discover it.
Well, I'm thrilled that George Michael has meant that we're about to listen to the L'Après-Midi, one of my favourite pieces. Actually, Leonard Bernstein said that this piece and Tristan were the beginnings of 20th century music.
I was discussing that with a friend of mine, Jane, who studied music at university, and she said, described it as whimsical, meandering, and hard to pin down, and she hates it. But that's precisely why I like it.
That's what I love about it. It's sensuous, too.
Yeah, and I know he was heavily influenced by Impressionism, and it does feel like you're in a lost in a painting.
So where do we find this in George Michael?
It's from a track called To Be Forgiven from the album Older, If Memory Serves.
Prelude à l'après-midi d'un fond by Claude Debussy, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra with Emmanuel Paoud on the flute and conducted by the great Claudio Abbado. Satnam Sangiri, your book Marriage Material came out in 2014 and was a modern adaptation of Arnold Bennett's 1908 novel Old Wives' Tale. What took you to that and what did you want to do with it?
Well, the Arnold Bennett book is set in a shop just about 34 miles away from Wolverhampton, and it's about a family running that shop, two sisters who are of marriageable age, and it struck me that all the dilemmas they face were pretty much precise dilemmas faced by Punjabi immigrants running shops in Wolverhampton about 100 years later. The obsession with marriage, the obsession with hard work, also the corner shop as a phenomenon that unites Britain. So I transposed it, because I also love that book, The Old Wives' Tale, by Arnold Bennett, and it's so amazing and delightful when people tell me they've read both.
And the book examines the race riots of the 1960s in Wolverhampton, and the riots that began in London and then moved across the UK in 2011 in reaction to the death of Mark Duggan, a black man from Tottenham who'd been shot by the police.
Yeah, and this is one way in which I slightly regret writing the book when I did, because I'm trying to compare what happened in our contemporary times to what was happening around the time of Enoch Powell in my hometown. But actually, if I waited a few years for Brexit, that would have been the better comparison, because I do think in many ways Brexit was the fulfillment of Powellism. Enoch Powell is a man who, he's a figure that shows up in all of my books, partly because, you know, the Rivers of Blood speech is one of the most important speeches, I think, of the 20th century in British politics. And people forget that in that speech, he's talking about Sikh migrants to Wolverhampton. He's talking about my parents who were just arriving when he made that speech. And I think that shows how wrong he was, because the British Sikh community is widely celebrated for the way it's managed to integrate at the same time as keeping some of its traditions. And so I think my community is a sign of just how wrong he was. And it's an argument that needs to be made again and again, because sadly, Powell and his speech are still being celebrated.
Your paternal grandfather was the first part of the wave of immigration, wasn't he? Working in a foundry in the black country.
Yeah, and a lot of his sons came. He had 14 children, I think. And lots of them did that hard manual labour that there weren't enough people to do in the Midlands at that time. And that's another thing that gets forgotten about mass immigration at the time, is that they were serving an economic function. And they helped Britain recover after World War II. Also, Asians and Sikhs fought in huge numbers in both world wars, something I was never taught at school.
You've written about the racism you faced growing up in The Boy with a Topknot, often about how in your family it was glossed over or minimised, even when serious. And we saw an example of that in the series you made for Channel 4, talking to people who clearly just didn't want to face up to it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big pressure at the time, I think, from people of my parents' generation to just get on, because they wanted to stand on their two feet. You know, the struggle was real. But, I mean, on particular incidents, I remember there being a lot of Nazi and NF signs on our house and the houses nearby. And I didn't know what the NF symbol meant. I just liked the way the F hung off the end. I remember drawing it on a balloon and taking the balloon around and my sister bursting it, but never explaining why she burst it. I think there was a sense of, let's just not talk about it, because that's easier.
Did it affect you very much when you were young, at a more profound level?
I don't think it did, actually. I don't think I faced huge amounts of racism. But I know that people of my generation did. It doesn't stop me observing it. And it doesn't stop me observing that there's hardly any black people in my industry, that representations of Muslims are very low, So just because I've not experienced it massively, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Peace is at the heart of our next music.
Yeah, this is a Muslim musician singing a Qawwali-style hymn from the Sikh holy book. It's hard to explain just how radical that felt when the first time I came across it, because the tensions between Sikhs and Muslims have been profound for centuries. First of all, between the Sikhs and the Mughal emperors, then during partitions where Sikhs and Muslims murdered each other. Even today, there's some Sikhs joined the EDL because of the Islamophobia. But that's not how the religion began. The foundations of the religion were very respectful towards Islam and also to Hinduism. And 100 years ago, in the Sikh holy temple, the Golden Temple, you would have seen Muslim musicians playing because they were descendants of the Muslim companion to Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh religion. And I love this track because the lyrics talk about how the God of the Hindus is the same God as the God of the Muslims. And for me, it highlights the ultimate message of Sikhism, which is that you should recognize the human race as one.
And this musician, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, is an absolute genius, isn't he?
I think one of the best voices in the history of the world, at least in recorded music, right? But I didn't realize he's actually recorded some Sikh hymns. And actually, he's also visited Slough Gurdwara and recorded some live music there, the same music.
Bole Ram Ram, performed by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. What does it mean, Kawibole?
Kawibole Rama means some people praise Ram, some people praise Allah, and it's the same. That's the sentiment in the lyric.
What is it about his music making that you think makes it so special?
Just the incredible range of his voice, isn't it? And the unity, also there's something amazing about the diversity of his audience, because you don't have to be a Sufi Muslim to recognise his talent and his popularity beyond India, right? He was quite big in the West as well, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
And I think that's really moving.
That's where music transforms, translates, transponds, you know, if you like, gets across barriers, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I wish, you know, that kind of music was being played in the Sikh temple when I went every Sunday morning. And I wish I'd listened harder, because there are probably vocalists almost as good as that playing for 30 people in Wolverhampton, and I just didn't recognise it.
Satnam Sangari, your book, Empire Land, How Imperialism Has Shaped Modern Britain, the publication could hardly be more timely, coinciding with Black Lives Matter. But it was obviously something you had been working on much earlier.
Yeah, it was accidentally timely. Unfortunately, you can't time books because they take 3 or 4 years to write. I'd been thinking about it a lot because I basically got to a stage of my life where I realised a lot of things about my life could be explained by the British Empire. The fact that I'm here is because we have a multicultural society, because we had a multicultural empire. Also, the Sikh identity, you know, to a large degree shaped by the British. The idea we're a martial race, and the demographics of Sikhs shaped by the British too. And yet I knew almost nothing about the British Empire. I'd been taught nothing about it. And so I just started looking into it, hoping that my ignorance and my education could help other people.
Is it true that it was going to be a book about a man called Dean Mohammed?
Yeah, it began as a novel about Dean Mohammed, who was this quite entertaining figure, the first ever Indian to come to London. He set up the first curry house. He became a kind of massage therapist to the king, had an amazing life. And I started researching his life, but again, you know, he came over with the East India Company, and I knew nothing about the East India Company. And very quickly, the research became more interesting than his story.
You describe how the British Empire began in the 16th century, then sped up during the 18th, until at its height, it covered approximately a quarter of the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. The British Empire explains so much, because of its size, explains so many things about people's daily life around the world. The fact that Indians drink tea, it was the British who made that a mass market product. Sugar, patterns of tax avoidance. But also there's barely a day that goes by where there isn't a news story that can be explained by the British Empire. At the moment, Israel-Palestine, that is a situation the British largely created, right? There's situations happening now in Guyana where the borders have been disputed that might lead to war. That is also because of the British Empire. I think you need to understand the British Empire to understand your daily life, but also to understand the world.
You're keen to convey the sheer variety of imperial experiences over those four centuries, the tone, the culture of empire, which varied wildly, didn't it, during the history?
Yeah, this is my surprising conclusion, I guess, in my new book, Empire World, is that the legacies are largely contradictory. British Empire resulted in a weird amount of democracy. It also resulted in a huge amount of geopolitical chaos in Palestine, Burma, Sudan, Nigeria. It spread environmental destruction. It also led to the birth of environmentalism. It spread the free press, but it also spread press censorship. And these legacies are not just complex, they're profoundly contradictory. We don't have to come to an over conclusion about whether they were good or bad overall. We can study the contradictory legacies as discrete phenomena.
You document some of the horrors of empire. The invasion of Tibet in 1903 is particularly shocking, I think, with a description from an English lieutenant at the time talking about getting so sick of the slaughter that I ceased fire.
I think that line highlights something very important. It's often said, oh, you know, imperial historians bang on less because you shouldn't apply modern morals onto the past. But people at the time were outraged quite frequently. I mean, I can't think of a single controversy during empire that wasn't imposed by either British soldiers or imperialists. I mean, the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, which happened in the early 1900s, Winston Churchill described it as monstrous. Gladstone opposed a lot of imperial policies. And we need to remember that opposing empire is a proud British tradition just as it was to support Empire.
Is it difficult to remain calm as you write about some of these events? Although in a later book, I think the anger begins to come through. But did you find it easy to kind of detach yourself to a certain extent?
It can get bleak, but I found writing it fine. What's hard is talking about it on the media, because British Empire is the most explosive subject around there, suddenly, out of nowhere, really, because it covers racism, misogyny, exploitation, and everyone seems to know a little bit about it and will bang on about it. And so introducing the world to the idea that opposite things can be true at the same time is something I feel that social media can't handle. Politics can't handle it, but books can. So writing a book is fine, but talking about it on social media and on the BBC is a very difficult thing. I mean, I got trolled a lot. A lot of people came to my events and started shouting at me. But I would say overall it was 95% positive. And, you know, the book is being used as a teaching resource in hundreds of schools. And every week a student comes to me and says they've been inspired by the book to study history at university.
A Billy Strayhorn number next.
Oh, Lush Life, of course, yes. This was the first ever track I loved on Radio 3. I remember recording it on my tape recorder. Weirdly, I know I loved it as a teenager, and I discovered recently that he was a teenager when he wrote it. And yet it's a song about being jaded, isn't it? It just goes to show you that there's no one more jaded in life than someone who hasn't really experienced it yet.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come-what-may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces with distant K-traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day 12 o'clock tales. Then you came along with your siren song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. Again, I was wrong. Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure. Life is awful again, a trough full of hearts could only be a bore. A week in Paris, please, the bite of it, all I care is to smile. In spite of it, I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is much stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too. Thank you.
is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too.
Makes me want to leave the BBC, walk into the Langham Hotel and order a really strong martini, vodka martini with a twist, and just drink it very slowly.
Lush Life, composed by Billy Strayhorn, wonderfully sung by Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane, vocalising on the saxophone. I mean, that's what music can do, isn't it? Variation form is what it is. And somebody comes in and says, you've sung this, this is my take on it, on the sax.
Yeah, you can instantly recognise it's John Coltrane, can't you, from the way he plays it. I have the same thing with Stevie Wonder's harmonica. I can spot it on a track a mile off. But yeah, it's amazing. They turn it into their own voice, don't they?
Satnam Sangara, in Empire Land, you give examples of how imperialism affected you growing up, and one issue was housing. Immigrants were given no access to council housing. So what did that mean in practical terms for you and your family?
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's why, you know, the Punjabi Sikhs, my family and almost everyone I know, were living in slum housing, because that was the only housing we were really allowed to buy. You know, I was shocked to read in retrospect how bad the racism has been. Even until the mid-80s, there were working men's clubs in Wolverhampton that didn't allow brown people to come in. And I was shocked that there were protests when brown people got council houses or council flats. And that was in the 70s. And that Wolverhampton Wanderers fans were known for wearing KKK hoods to matches, you know. Mm. I didn't experience that as a kid. I didn't know what was happening. All I knew is that my mum wouldn't let me out of the house when there was a Wolves match. But also how far we've come. Because now I'm now a Wolves fan. We recently had a captain who was half Punjabi. It's got huge support from the Asian community in Wolverhampton. Things have come a long way.
Nevertheless, after Empire Land was published, you did get quite a lot of hateful, racist comments.
I think this history feels very personal for a lot of people because they have families who were involved in Empire, either as colonised or the colonisers. And so when you see someone of colour pointing out the Empire had been racist, they take it personally. And often that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying you're relatives are racist. I'm saying that it could be. Some people, at certain times, Empire definitely was white supremacist. Other times, it could be incredibly tolerant. Opposite things can be true at the same time.
And was writing about it your kind of therapy, coming to terms with it for yourself?
I think therapy is a very good analogy because I feel like as a country, that's what we need. Some people say, you know, you must hate Britain to dig up this dark history. And it's like, no, it's like I have therapy. It doesn't mean I hate my parents. I'm just trying to process my feelings and work on the darker elements of my life. And as a country, I think we need to do the same thing.
The next music, My Friend the Forest. Tell me where this came into your life.
Well, I've said I listen to music when I'm writing, but occasionally hip-hop and Tupac gets too much and I need a bit of quiet. And Nils Fram is the artist that I've just ended up listening to when I really need to concentrate. I really like the way he mixes classical with electronic. I really love how quiet he gets sometimes. And in this track, you can almost hear him shuffling in his chair. Thank you. I've never heard that so loud. And I heard loads of things I'd not heard before.
My Friend the Forest, composed and performed by Nils Frahm. You made Satnam Sangera in 2021 a TV programme for Channel 4 called Empire State of Mind, where you travelled around the UK looking at the effects of British Empire on modern Britain. And you met a man called Alex Renton, who had discovered, to his horror, connections with his family.
Yeah, Alex Renton is this amazing journalist who wrote a book called Blood Legacy, which is about the ways in which his aristocratic Scottish family were involved in some of the darkest aspects of slavery and plantation work in the West Indies. And he concludes at the end of this that his family owe reparations to those people, the descendants of the people who were exploited by his family. When you mention reparations in this country, people clutch their pearls and, like, they can't believe you're even talking about it. But the process has begun with people like Alex already. Also, it's begun in other ways. I mean, our relationship with Ireland has been reconfigured, I would say, through a process of post-colonial truth and reconciliation. The Good Friday Agreement, there were apologies, there was money paid out. It's been reconfigured with Kenya, where we were taken to court and had to pay £20 million in compensation and apologise to them. And William Hague made an official apology. The process has already begun, although we act like it's an abstract, absurd idea. But I think people, Alex, it was really interesting to meet him on that documentary.
You describe how complicated imperial history is. And, for example, the role that Sikhs played during the Indian Mutiny.
Yeah, I mean, the Sikhs largely took the side of the British. And it's part of the reason why the British developed these weird ideas that we were a special martial race, mainly because we took their side. So they thought we were the chosen ones. But equally, Sikhs were also, you know, blown from the ends of cannons when necessary. You know, at Jallianwala Bagh, there were Sikh soldiers both during the shooting and being shot at. So we occupy a complicated position in empire.
And would you pull down statues? Would you erase artworks that are connected to slavery?
I'm not generally into that, but also I think statues, there's too much emphasis on them. They're just street furniture. We've only just begun to notice them. They've been around for centuries, and I think there's bigger issues.
Educational side of it, actually understanding, knowing what's happening, is more important than those manifestations.
Yeah, totally. It's much more important to understand the geopolitical chaos we caused in India and in Nigeria and Myanmar and Palestine, Sudan and Kashmir, rather than focus on a statue.
Baghdad Cafe is a film that led you to the next piece of music.
Yes, interesting that I barely remember anything about the film, but the song really remains, doesn't it? I mean, gosh, such a stunning song. And I think I really admire people who can do things I can't do. And one of the things I can't do is sing. And I could barely hold a tune for a nursery rhyme. And the vocal on this is stunning.
Well, we found an orchestral version for you, which still got a vocal.
Really, I'm scared that you're going to play the Celine Dion version.
No.
desert road from Vegas to nowhere. Someplace better than where you've been. A coffee machine that needs some fixing. In a little cafe just around the bend. Better than where you've been. A coffee machine that needs some fixing. In a little cafe just around the bend.
Had a voice like that, I would never leave the house. I think I'd just stand in the shower and sing to myself.
Calling you from Baghdad Cafe, vocals from Nolwenn Leroy, and the violin solo was played by Renaud Capuçon, with the Brussels Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Stéphane Deneuve. Sutton Sangera, your latest book, Empire World, traces the legacy the British Empire has had across the globe, as opposed to across the British Isles. 2.6 billion people are inhabitants of former colonies.
Yeah, it's shocking how far it went. And also, for the book, I travelled a lot, which comes not easily to me, someone who doesn't really like leaving Wolverhampton. So I went to Nigeria, Mauritius, India, and Barbados. And it's amazing how the empire still is a real thing that affects people's lives on a daily basis, you know. And there's so much phenomena that I just had no idea could be explained by empire. For example, ganja, something associated with Jamaican culture, actually introduced by Indian indentured labourers sent there by the British. I mean, you think about it, ganja is a Hindi word. It seems obvious now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But rum, gin and tonic, driving on the left, cricket, the Western suit, Christianity, and actually Islam too. I mean, because people were converted to Christianity, some people drifted towards Islam because it allowed them to keep some of their traditions rather than converting to Christianity. So there's all sorts of direct and indirect legacies.
I found the writing in this book really passionate.
Oh, I'm so glad. Because I struggle with history books because I think academics try hard to be the opposite. They try to be dispassionate.
Well, you brought a lot to us today, Satnam, so I believe the final piece is something we brought to you.
Indeed. It's a track I first heard on Radio 3 in one of your late night sessions when Radio 3 goes crazy. And I thought it was a very interesting track to hear on Radio 3 because it could have been on Radio 1, could have been on 6 Music. It's a mix of genres. It's jazz, it's choral, it's hip-hop, it's soul. But I love it. It's an amazing soundscape and it's like having a bath. So I'm grateful for the gift of this song from Radio 3.
This is Decisions, composed and performed by Taylor McFerrin, accompanied by the singer Emily King. So it only remains for me to thank you very much, Satnam Sangeera, for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Decisions, composed and performed by Taylor McFerrin, accompanied by singer Emily King. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the writer Satnam Sangera. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the classicist Edith Hall, who wants everyone to understand how the writing and thinking of ancient Greece still influences how we write and think today. And her music choices will include composers who found inspiration in Greek myth, among them Gluck and Handel. That's Private Passions next Sunday on Radio 3 at midday.
Enjoy unique performances you won't hear anywhere else. The very best classical music from venues all over the world with Radio 3 in concert.
And Friday night is Music Night arrives on Radio 3 with the BBC Concert Orchestra dazzling us with works from the golden age of light music and the very best from the big screen. Incredible live classical music all year round, every weekday evening from 7:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Now, here on BBC Radio 3, with the time at 1:30, we set off on a musical journey.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach, and today we're heading in the direction of a piece of music that Brahms said creates a whole world of deep thought and powerful feeling with just one musical stave and just one instrument. This is the Chaconne, a 15-minute colossus that ends an otherwise relatively tame suite for solo violin in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. And today we'll be plotting it on our music map, listening forwards and backwards in time, creating Venn diagrams of sound, and following paths that lead us directly towards it. We'll hear the whole thing in full towards the end of today's show at about 3:15. Let's start with another chaconne. Derived from a triple time dance, it's a simple, repeating bass line which becomes the stage for increasingly virtuosic variations. Thank you.